Good evening. This will be, just to mention before we start the share, the final share in the current series. We'll meet again, Mirz Hashem, in 3 weeks' time. That is the Monday of Parshas Kisetse. Of course, a lot can happen between now and then, Geula, we hope. If it does, either way, we'll be in touch via email, and we're in Yerushalayim, so that's the right place. And if it expands, then all the more so. But we start our discussion at the beginning of Parshas Voischanan, and there's actually a mitzvah that we find towards the beginning of the parsha. That's in Perek Dalet. Pasuk Aleph, you could say, is a lead into the mitzvah. So let's read Pasuk Aleph and Pasuk Beis of Perek Dalet. Ve'ata Yisrael, says Moshe, and now Yisrael, shma el hachukim v'al mishpatim, listen or heed to the chukim, the statutes, the laws, asher anochi melamed eschem, la'asos, that I'm teaching you, leman tichyu, that you should live, uvosem v'reshtem es ha'aretz, and come and inherit the land, asher Hashem elokei avosechem nosein lachem. So keep all the mitzvahs, you should come and inherit the land, and that is followed by Pasuk Beis, lo sosifu. Do not add on, al hadavar asher anochi mitzaveh eschem, v'lo sigru mimenu, do not detract from it, lishmor es mitzvos Hashem elokeichem asher anochi mitzaveh eschem. So this Pasuk introduces to us the concept of lo sosifu, what then becomes known in the halachic parlance as bal tosif, not to add on to a mitzvah, and then bal tigra, the opposite number. And these are two negative prohibitions of taryag. What exactly does it mean? What does that comprise? Adding to the mitzvah, not detracting from the mitzvah. Rashi gives three examples. Lo sosifu, says Rashi, kagon chamesh parshios betfilin, like if a person would have five paragraphs written in the tefillin instead of the four. Or chamesh es minim balulav, five species for the lulav and esrog instead of the four. The chamesh tzitzios, or five tzitzis attached, that would be baltosif. That's adding on to the mitzvah. V'chein lo tigru, and likewise, not to detract from the mitzvah. If one would have tefillin with only three parshas, or tzitzis with only three strings. Or, interestingly, it seems, only three of the four species. We can envisage a situation where a person may only have three of the four. If he's looking to get hold of them naturally, he may not get all four of them. And we might have thought, well, at least do what you can do. But it sounds like if he takes three of them, that's actually lo tigru'u. That's detracting from the mitzvah. And that's the implication there. We do note, and this is always will be in one of the in-between parshas for us, I do not believe we've ever had a shiur on parshas Re'eh, but bal tosif will come back. It is reiterated in parshas Re'eh, bal tosif, lo tosif ulo tigra, and there's a lot of discussion. Rashi there gives other examples of bal tigra, or bal tosif, and that is bal tosif there. The only other point to mention, again briefly because we've discussed this in the past, is that the examples of bal tosif that Rashi is mentioning are adding on to any particular given mitzvah. If it's the mitzvah of tefillin, to have five parshios instead of four. If it's tzitzis, to have five strings instead of four. There is another version or variation of bal tosif, which Rashi doesn't talk about at all, and that is not so much adding on something to one of the mitzvahs, but adding on a mitzvah to the body of mitzvahs of taryag. That is to say, to add an entirely new mitzvah, whatever it might be. And Rashi doesn't speak about that, and neither does the Gemara openly. It's something that we find more in the Rishonim. The Rambam states explicitly, and so does the Ramban, in his discussion here, that these are two variations, not only to add on to a mitzvah, but add on a mitzvah to the body of Taryag, to turn 613 into 614. Which leads to the question, what about the mitzvahs of the Rabbanon? They need to be added very carefully in a way that they're clearly attachments to existing mitzvahs and not new mitzvahs of themselves. And many Mefarshim have actually suggested that these two types of Baal Tosif actually are reflected in the two appearances of the mitzvah in the Torah. The one in Parshas Vayeshanan refers to adding on to a mitzvah, the one in Parshas Re'eh, or vice versa, adding a mitzvah to Taryag, and in the later one, adding on to a mitzvah. There's a lot of discussion how the two possibilities, or the two ideas within the Lo Saaseh land in these two mentionings of the Lo Saaseh. But I'd like to back away a little bit from the mitzvah here and from the halachic elements of the discussion here to ask perhaps a more basic question. Chumash Devarim is divided generally, one could say, into three parts. The first are words of rebuke and remonstration and encouragement from Moshe. And that will take us more or less till the middle of Parshas Re'eh, looking back over past mistakes, warnings for the future, lessons learned, exhortations. From the middle of Re'eh until roughly the middle of Kisavo are mitzvos. And that's where you'll find all the concentration of the mitzvos of Chumash Devarim. And then from there till the end is about the future, Nitzavim Vayelech, future times, and so on. That roughly, and this is the division of the Vilna Gaon of Chumash Devarim into these three: words of rebuke and exhortation, mitzvos, and future times. So much so, if you look back in the beginning of Chumash Devarim, Parshas Devarim, you'll see it effectively introduces the Sefer three times. And each one lands and relates to a different part of the Sefer as per the Vilna Gaon. If this is the case, so we then ask a simple question. What is a mitzvah doing in the not yet mitzvah section of Chumash Devarim? An interesting shayla. And the one who steps in to answer this question is the Or HaChaim HaKadosh. And he begins by taking us back to the beginning of the Parsha. Vayeshanan begins with Moshe's entreaties to Hashem to enter the land, and Hashem does not allow him to do so, and tells him to stop davening, actually. He doesn't allow him to enter the land, but he will, yes, be allowed to ascend the mountain and to see the land, but that's it. No more. All of that is from the opening of the Parsha until, effectively, Pasuk Kafches. Moshe's request to see the land, it's denied. To enter the land, it's denied. All he can do is to descend the mountain to see it. Pasuk Kaftes of Perek Gimel happens so quickly and it's so brief, it's easy for not to have noticed that anything happened at all before we move in and before we move on. But of course, we need to stop and look at it. Pasuk Kaftes, Vaneshev Bagai, Mul Beis Peor. We settled opposite Beis Peor. Next, Baal Tosef. Next thing you know, it's already Perek Dalet. The transition into a new chapter is not correct. Meaning, as we've mentioned many times, the chapters, chapter 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on of the Chumashim, are not Jewish in inception, and this was terribly ill-advised. It's literally a progression of what was mentioned before, but either way, whoever did it, it was a non-Jewish in inception, but Goy had mazel, and everyone uses that system. But these psukim follow on. Baal Tosef. What is this Pasuk Kaftes, which seems to just put us in a new location, Mul Beis Peor. Now we know that a lot happened in Beis Peor, which we'll get back to. But how do these form pieces? And it is a continuum from the beginning of the parsha to Baal Tosef. Says the Aruch Haim HaKadosh, a stunning chiddush. The parsha begins with Moshe pleading, entreating, that Hashem will allow him to enter the land. It doesn't work, because it had already been decreed that Moshe would not be able to enter the land. Why? When? As a result of what? Well, as we know, as a result of what happened with the Memeriva, with the hitting of the rock. There's many interpretations, but the most straightforward interpretation is that Moshe should have spoken to the rock, but he did more than that. He hit the rock, which was not really told to do. And as a result of that, it is decreed upon him that he cannot enter the land of Israel. The way that that is expressed in the Pasuk, Hashem says on more than one occasion, Yan lo he'emantem bi lahakdisheni, because you did not sanctify me, le'enei b'nei Yisrael. It's what we could very, very carefully call, well, it's reading the Pasuk. It's a lack of Kiddush Hashem. A lack of sanctifying Hashem's name. Hashem said to speak, and Moshe. And as a result of that, Moshe can't go in. That is a very, very dire punishment. Says the Aruch Haim HaKadosh, it could have been averted, or more correctly, it could have been reversed. The decree could have been undone. How? If Moshe committed whatever sin that it was, how can it be reversed? Says the Aruch Haim HaKadosh, by doing the reverse. If the reason that it was decreed upon Moshe not to enter the land is because he was guilty of lack of Kiddush Hashem, then what if Moshe should be able to find a situation, or if it presents itself, and Moshe then steps forward and is Mekadosh Hashem? So Kiddush Hashem could compensate for the lack of Kiddush Hashem earlier on. Says the Aruch Haim HaKadosh, it could have happened. And you know where it could have happened? Baal Peor, Beis Peor, the events at the end of Parshas Balak with the daughters of Moab, and then it culminates with Zimri, and he takes Cosby, and something has to be done. And in the end, Pinchas does it. And it's a Kiddush Hashem. He steps forward, takes action on Hashem's behalf, stops the plague, does what needs to be done. Publicly, that's a Kiddush Hashem. Pinchas did it, and he received great reward. Brisi Shalom, Bris Kehunas Olam. Moshe didn't do it, says the Aruch Haim HaKadosh, and I wonder if anyone has said this before him, because I think it's an amazing Kiddush. If Moshe had been the one to dispense justice against Zimri and Cosby, that would have been enough for him to reverse the decree not to go into Eretz Canaan, because that would have been a Kiddush Hashem to counter the earlier forfeit of Kiddush Hashem. But he didn't do it. Pinchas did. And therefore Moshe can't go in. What does this have to do with Baal Tosef and Baal Tigra? Says Aruch Haim HaKadosh. Moshe is looking to emphasize the importance of not adding on when you're not meant to add on, and not detracting what you're not meant to detract. And where does he emphasize this from? Upon whose experience does he draw? His own. Because if we were to summarize these two events of Mei Meriva, the hitting of the rock, and of Baal Peor, we could say that one of them was Baal Tosef, and the other was Baal Tigra. Mei Meriva is Baal Tosef, because Moshe was meant to speak to the rock, but he did more than that, and it wasn't warranted, and it was out of place and wrong. And he added another measure, and he hit the rock. That's Baal Tosef, and he suffered from it. He could have recovered by taking action, but at the time that he could have taken action, he didn't. What's that called? Baal Tigra, says Moshe Rabbeinu to the Jewish people, in what must have been, if we may presume to say, a very painful communication. You see what happened to me when I did Bal Tosef in Bal Tigra? Don't let that happen to you. That's how we're not yet formally in the mitzvah section of Devarim. But this has to be said now. When the impact and the association that people will have on a personal level is set, and it's classic parshanut, all of a sudden, all these things fit in. It begins with Vayeschanan el Hashem, that very brief reference to Baal Peor, Baneshev Bagai, and then all this leads us into Baal Tosef and Baal Tigra. That is the classic comment of the Orach Chaim HaKadosh. While Moshe is not allowed to enter the land, he is told to go up and see the land, to ascend the mountain. That is allowed. And let us see that pasuk. This is in Perek Gimel Pasuk Kaf Zayin. Hashem says, Alei Rosh HaPisgah, go ascend to the peak. V'so einecha yama v'tzafona v'timana u'mizracha. And look around all the directions, u'rev einecha, and see with your eyes. Now, a very interesting question, if one may say, a detail-oriented question, but once it's raised, hard to ignore. Moshe is not the first person in the Torah to be told to look in all four directions, or where all four directions are mentioned. The very first person that is told to do that is Avram, and that's in Parshas Lech Lecha, in Perek Yud Gimel. The Pasuk states in Perek Yud Gimel, Pasuk Yud Dalet, Vashem Amar Avram, Acharei Pared Lot Meimo, once Lot had left Avram, Sona Einecho Re'ei, raise up your eyes and see from where you are. Safona vanegba vakedma vayama. You got your four directions again. And before we take a closer look at those four directions, the other one in Bereishis I think is more famous. Yaakov at the ladder in Parshas Vayetze, where Hashem says, Ufaratzta yama vakedma safona vanegba. Now, those two mentionings of all of the four directions, they're not exactly the same, but they're very similar to each other very basic way. And that is, they both have the directions as being opposite from each other. I hesitate to use the term crisscross, but they go from one to the other, and then in the other way, one to the other. That means, for example, if we go back to Avram Avinu, in Perek Yud Gimel, Pasuk Yud Dalet, Hashem says, look at the directions, Safona Vanegba, north and south, and then Kedma Vayoma, east and west. So you have these are the two vectors. Similarly with Yaakov, Ufaratzta, Yama Vakedma, west and east, Safona Vanegba, north and south. And again, the internal difference between those two needs to be understood, but that's seemingly how it should be done. So coming back to our pasuk, we find something very interesting. Because now Hashem says, Sana Elecha, Yama v'tzafona v'teimana u'mizracha, it's all over the place. West and north and south and east, it's whatever happened to the symmetry, east to west, north to south. Why is it in this way? A very interesting shaila. And this question is raised by Reb Shimon Schwab. So if it sounds like a Yekesha shaila, now you know why. It's absolute attention to detail. And the answer he gives is quite fascinating. The idea of Moshe seeing the land, if we may ask the question, what does that achieve? What does that do, either for Moshe or for anyone? Moshe's original request was to enter the land. As he says in the beginning of the parsha, Evrana ve'er'eh, let me go in, let me see, he wants to enter the land. There is a famous Gemara in the end of the first parak of Maseches Sota, Yudalad Amid Aleph, Rav Samloi, asks, why does Moshe want to enter the land? And Rav Samlai continues, rhetorically, v'chilechol mipuya, v'lisbo mituva. What, he wants to eat the fruits of the land of Israel? That's why he wants to go in? No. Ela, Omar Moshe, harbe mitzvos nitzdav Yisrael. The Jewish people have been commanded with many mitzvos, v'einu miskaimen ela ba'aretz. And they can only do them in the land of Israel. We know there's many, many mitzvahs can only be done in the land of Israel. Ekones, says Moshe, I would like to go in. V'yiskay mukulan al yadi. That's why he wants to go in. Now, I deliberately did not translate those final words because our first impression of those words is that, you know why he wants to go into the land of Israel? Not to eat the fruits of the land, although we actually asked that we should do that in Al HaMichya. That very same expression, we asked that we should do that. It doesn't sound like it's such a bad thing, but it can't be the subtotal of why he wants to go in. So he doesn't want to go in for the fruits, rather he wants to enter the land for the mitzvahs. But actually, Moshe did not say, let me enter the land to do the mitzvahs. He says, let me enter the land so that the mitzvahs will be fulfilled through me. Ekones, V'yiskaimu kulan al yadi. What does it mean for the mitzvahs to be fulfilled through Moshe as opposed to Moshe doing the mitzvahs? There are many Mefarshim who say that at this stage Moshe knows he will not enter the land to live there. And in fact, the simple meaning of his words, in the beginning of the Parsha, he says, let me enter the land and see it. It sounds like that's all he wants to do. He did not say, let me enter the land, which implies permanently. Or let me enter the land and live there. He says, let me enter the land and see it. It sounds like after that, he understands that he will need to leave again. So what is the purpose of this temporary visit? But as we know, the mitzvahs that apply in the land of Israel are activated by the Jewish presence in the land. Mitzvahs hatluyos ba'aretz, land-based mitzvahs, require kedushas ha'aretz, and the kedusha of the aretz for these mitzvahs is activated by the presence of the Jewish people in the land. Moshe knows that at this stage that he's not going to live in the land of Israel, but he wants the final merit, at least to have a hand, at least to play a role in instilling the kedusha within the land. By doing what? By entering the land. Moshe is the leader of the Jewish people. He is equal in stature to all the Jewish people. If he enters the land, it will be a decisive step in the bestowing and instilling of the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. And all of the mitzvahs that will then be fulfilled will have been fulfilled not by him, because he will no longer be in the land, but through him, through the Kedusha that he activated. That's Moshe's goal. Now that was denied him, at least in total. But it wasn't totally denied him. In other words, if that's what Moshe has in mind when he wants to enter the land, so when Hashem says you can't enter but you can see the land, we need to appreciate that this was a proactive viewing. Meaning, it made a difference. It had an effect on the land. As surely as Moshe cannot physically enter the land, but to establish eye contact with the land, already is in some measure has begun the process of instilling the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. And it's an amazing thing to consider. With this in mind, says Reb Shimon Schwab, let us go back to the directions. And in fact, let's ask even a more balabatisha question. Moshe wants to see the land. Where is the land? It's on the other side of the mountain. In which directions? Well, west. North and south. And Hashem says, look east also. If he looks east, he's basically turning around and looking at the place where he's living at the moment. Why does he need to do that? He doesn't need to ascend the mountain to see where he is. And that's not where he really where he wants to look. I mean, that's a fundamental question. He should only need to be looking in three directions to see the land. What, east? That's where he's from, the east. He's seen plenty of east. He's seen nothing but east for the last year. However, as we discussed a couple of weeks ago. If the idea of the east side, what's called Transjordan, Evar Yarden Mizracha, also has elements of the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. With regards to certain mitzvahs, as we saw, even ultimately with regards to the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael as an expansion of Eretz Canaan. If that's the case, then we understand why Moshe also should be looking east, because the bestowing of the Kedusha ultimately will need to happen on the east side as well. But the critical question is, when? When does the east side of the Yarden receive its Kedusha? As we discussed again a couple of weeks ago, if it's an expansion, so then the full Kedusha is not going to happen until the land itself has its Kedusha, which can then expand eastwards. Which is why Moshe says, you won't settle there until Eretz Canaan on the west has been settled. In order to establish it in Eretz Canaan proper, it can then move eastwards. And that is what is behind the order of the directions that are told to Moshe to look at the land. The first direction he's told to look is Yama, because if he ascends the mountain, most of the land is directly there in front of him to the west. Any other directions of Eretz Canaan itself? Yes, north and south. The final direction, once all of Eretz Yisrael has really been covered by these three directions of west, north, and south, now you turn back and look at the east. Because once Eretz Canaan has its Kedusha, the east side can attain its Kedusha. But that's why there is no east-west or west-east. East comes last, because the Kedusha on the east side comes after it exists in every other place. So these are fascinating. Again, especially as it's born from paying attention to such a detail, the order of the directions to get an inkling of how much is contained within all of these details is really, really quite something. As we move a bit further into the Parsha, we have, of course, the recap of Mamad Har Sinai, of the Aseres HaDibros. And there are a number of differences between the Aseres HaDibros as we see them here and as we found them in Parshas Yisro. Classic among them is Shomer versus Zohar, Zohar versus Shomer. Another famous difference is that when it comes to, for example, Kibud Av V'Em, Kabed Es Avicha V'Simecha, so in Parshas Yisro, it says L'man Yarichun Yamecha. You should have a long life. In our Parsha, V'Eschanan, it adds U'Leman Yitavlach. It should be good for you. And this addition or change was the subject of a discussion in the Gemara between Rabbi Chanina and Rabbi Chia. And the discussion is as follows. Let's go through the stages because it's very well known. There's a lot to say about it. So Rabbi Chanina says to Rabbi Chia, ask this question. Why is it that in the first set of luchos, the word tov doesn't appear, but in the second it does? And he is, of course, referring to the fact that in Parshas Yisro, which is first time round, there is no Leman Yitavlach, and in Parshas Vayeschanan, there is Leman Yitavlach. So Rabbi Chanina wanted to know why that is. Why is there no tov the first time round? Says Rabbi Chia, in response, he says, you're asking me why there's a difference. I don't even know if there is a difference. I don't know that there is. So I can't help you. I don't know that the second one said Leman Yitavlach and the first one didn't. So I don't really know. I can't explain it because I don't really know that is what happened. So I can't help you. Someone who can help you is someone called Rav Tanchum, because he used to spend time with Rabbi Shua ben Levi. He's a Baal Agoda. He knows Agodos, and maybe he can help you. So Rabbi Chanina went to Rav Tanchum, and Rav Tanchum had an answer for him. And he said, because the first set of luchos were destined to be broken. And if the word tov appears, is engraved on the first set of luchos, then when the luchos are broken, the concept of goodness will then depart from the Jewish people. And that's why there is no mentioning of Tov with the first luchos, only in the second, which are there to stay. Now, needless to say, there's a lot to contemplate in this exchange. Certainly in terms of the final answer, which contains within it major statements. Firstly, the notion that the text on the first luchos was written with the understanding that they might yet become broken. So you don't want to put Tov on them because you don't want Tov to get broken. So they're written almost with a breaker-friendly format, which is a great chiddush, because as far as we know, the way heaven deals with people is to let people make their decisions, but up until that point, nothing's happened. But it's already with an inkling of the fact that they could be broken. Secondly, what exactly does it mean that if Tov is on there and the luchos get broken, then Tov departs from the Jewish people? Especially as there are many other things that are written on the first set of luchos. Do they depart from the Jewish people when the first luchos are broken? Most of them come back. So there's much to ponder in terms of exactly what the explanation is. But interestingly, many Mefarshim focus as much on the earlier part of the exchange, which is actually baffling. Namely, Rabbi Chanina says to Rabbi Chiya, why is there no reference of Tov in the first luchos and only in the second? And Rabbi Chiya says, well, I don't know. I mean, I don't even know that that's true. Well, it's in the Chumash. I mean, this is disturbing. Why don't you know what's in the Chumash? Ben Chumash leMikra. This is back in the day. So a child by the age of 10 will know that this is the case. So how do you not know? And moreover, let's say for argument's sake that you somehow don't know. So look it up. But in the end, he sends Rabbi Chanina to ask someone else. And the person that he asks is someone who keeps the company of Bali Agada, of Agadic teachings. But we're looking at the basics to find out what the Chumash is saying. You should send him to a Baal Mikra. And these questions are discussed by Rebuver Margolius, Zatzal, in one of his many Svarim. This one is called Hamikra Vamasora. And he explains as follows. We know that there were two sets of luchos. The first was broken on the 17th of Tammuz, not long ago. And the second were there to stay. They came down on Yom Kippur. So there are two sets of luchos. We also know that there are two presentations of the Ten Commandments in the Torah. The first is in Yisro. The second is in our parsha, in Vayeschanan. But now the crucial question is, are these two twos connected? Do they go with each other? As if to say, are we to understand that the notion of two sets of luchos lines up with the two presentations of the Aseres HaDibros, which on the one hand would make a lot of sense because the two presentations are not exactly the same, and therefore maybe the Nusach on the second luchos had a few changes for various reasons. So that sounds very reasonable. But it is not the only way to approach the situation. There is another way. It could be that maybe there were no differences between the text on the first set of luchos and the second. And should you ask, but then why are there discrepancies and differences between the Aseres HaDibros as we find in our Parsha versus the one in Yisro? How can you account for them if the Nusach on both luchos was the same? The answer may be very simple. Chumash Devarim is introduced as Moshe giving over the Torah and explaining it, which means that it's possible that as he's giving over the Aseres HaDibros, he was explaining them. As the pasuk says in the beginning of Devarim, Ho'el Moshe Be'er Es HaTorah Azos, words of Bior, Therefore, could it be that maybe it's not the way to think about it? That the two versions line up with the two sets of luchos? No, maybe both luchos have the same nusach, the same text. The two presentations of Aseres HaDibros are put down to Moshe adding words of Biur. And incidentally, from a certain point of view, maybe that's even more reasonable, parshanut-wise, because Moshe in our parsha says, remember when we all stood at Har Sinai and heard the following. So he's really taking us back to Shavuos, when we heard the text that would be on the first Luchos. But then we get the psukim are not exactly the same. Maybe it's added words of Biur. Could be. And this is why we understand now, it's such an important discussion vis-a-vis this exchange in the Gemara. We understand now that when Rabbi Chanina originally asked, why is there no mention of Tov in the first set of Luchos, only in the second set of Luchos, he's made a presumption. His presumption is that the text in Parshas, the Psukim in Parshas Yisro, correspond to the text of the first Luchos. So if there's no Tov there, that means there was no Tov written on the first Luchos. While the Psukim in Vaischanan correspond to the second set of Luchos, and it says Tov there. And because he made that assumption, he then asked the question, why is there no reference of Tov in the first Luchos? But Rabbi Chiya stops him, and Rabbi Chiya says, I don't know if what you're saying is true. And we were somewhat aghast. You don't know you don't know Chumash? Rabbi Chiya knows Chumash. Knowing Chumash won't help you. Because all you know is that the psukim are different, but you don't know that corresponds to the difference between the two sets of luchos. So Rabbi Chiya doesn't know. Opening a Chumash won't help you, and sending to an expert in Chumash won't help you. You need a Baal Agada. You need someone who has access to these teachings, to a Masorah, to traditions about all of these things. And that's why he sent him to Rabbi Tanchum. And Rabbi Tanchum endorsed his opening presumption. Namely, you are correct. When you look at Yisro and you see that it doesn't say Tov in the Psukim there, and in Vaischanan it does, you are correct in saying that's because in the first Luchos it didn't say Tov, and the second it did. The Psukim won't give you that, but you should know that it is so. We have a Masorah about this, says Rabbi Tanchum, the Baal Agada. And if you want to know why, it's because they were destined to be broken or could have been broken, and therefore Tov would have departed from the Jewish people. So through the cracks of the, and between the lines really, of this exchange, we've actually stumbled upon a question that we ourselves may naturally have made the assumption that Rabbi Chanina did and never have considered otherwise. And that is the classic observation of Reuven Margolius. Interestingly, one could say that there is, would I call it halachic fallout or implications from this question? Maybe. Certainly taryagic implications in the following way. The last of the Ten Commandments is Lo Tachmod. Do not covet. And in Parshas Yisro, that's basically what it says. In our Parsha, it says two things, Lo Tachmod and Lo Tis'aveh. Now, Lo Tis'aveh, from the word Ta'ava, desire, quite similar to Lo Tachmod, but additional to, it appears in our Parsha, but not in the original Yisro. And the question is, what does it add? The Rambam, taking his cue from the Gemara, it's Gemara in Bava Metzia, Daf Hei, explains that how does a person violate Lo Tachmod, not to covet? It's if you want something and you want it so badly that belongs to someone else that you pressure them incessantly until they give it to you or even sell it to you. It's still Lo Tachmod. You had to have it, you did whatever it takes to get it, and you got it, and now you violated Lo Tachmod. That's Lo Tachmod, that's the covet. Let a person have their own thing. He doesn't want to sell it to you. But you stand on his toes and you call him in the middle of the night until he agrees. So that's Lo Tachmod, even if you pay for it. So interestingly, Lo Tachmod is not the chemda, what we would call. that you want it. That's not yet violating the Tachmud until you follow through and actually take it from him. Our parsha, though, and by the way, this has reverberations for the famous question of the Ibn Ezra, because the Ibn Ezra asks, how can the Torah forbid a person to want something? And he gives this famous moshul with the princess and the villager. The villager doesn't desire the princess. She's out of his league. So says so Ibn Ezra, so someone else's possessions are out of your league. So finished. Get it out of your head. That's his answer. But according to the Rambam, the question doesn't begin, because actually the Torah does not forbid a person to want something. The violation is to actually take it from the other person. That's as per Lo Tachmod. But then in our parsha, we have the addition of Lo Tis'ave. And what is Lo Tis'ave? Says Rambam, if a person, even before he takes it, he starts to think, how can I get it from them? How will I get them to sell it to me? That's Lo Tis'ave. It's an additional level. So it sounds like we didn't successfully avoid the Ibn Ezra's kasha. We just delayed it for about 6 months. In other words, in Parshas Yisro, when it says Lo Tachmod, and the Ibn Ezra says, how can the Torah stop you from wanting something? You'll say, that's not what Lo Tachmod means. Says Ibn Ezra, okay, I'll see you in the summer. Because in Lo Tis'ave, so we're back. Because there it seems the Torah is about what a person wanting it and so on. Interestingly, even here, the Rambam doesn't say that Lo Tis'ave in our parsha is a prohibition against wanting something, but it's about developing the thought and plotting and planning and how to do it. And I wonder why, I haven't seen anyone who says this, but Lo Tis'ave is a reflexive. The Torah doesn't say Lo Te'ave, do not desire it. Lo Tis'ave, don't start building up that desire and into a plan and a plot. So it could be that even when you see Lo Tis'ave in our parsha, the Torah still isn't forbidding you from wanting something. But if you want it, forget about it. Or leave it at that. Or that's your problem, but not to start the plots, etc. So we have before us now two prohibitions. Lo Tachmod is to take it from him through pressure, and Lo Tis'ave is to plot to do that. Now there's a big chiddush here, halachically. Because it's the Rambam says, and it's from the Mechilta, an amazing thing in Hilchos Gezeila. Hata'ava mivia l'dei chimud. If you start wanting something, in the end, you'll take it from them. Perhaps legally. V'chimud mivia l'dei gezel. Taking something from someone legally could lead you to take it from them illegally. What if they don't want to sell? But you have to have it. So you're prepared to pay for it, but they're not prepared to sell it. You may take it anyway. That's the formulation. Now, the Rambam mentions this in halacha. It's not just to explain human psychology. It's a halachic pronouncement, it seems. Because it sounds like lo tachmod, which is don't pressure someone to sell you something if they don't want to sell, which me might think is just, that's not a very menschlich thing to do, but where's the isser? I did pay him for it. Says Rambam, you know why it's also? You're one step away from stealing. And the Sefer HaChinuch says this explicitly. Lo tachmod is a protective measure that you shouldn't come to steal. When the Torah prohibits you from pressuring him even if you'll pay, it's to protect that you may go, you may overstep and just take it from him and not pay. Now the reason why that's such a chiddush is because it turns out that lo tachmod is a protective measure. That's called the siyag. We are familiar with the concept of a protective measure. That's in the domain of the Chachamim. They make protective measures for the prohibitions of the Torah. But every once in a while, and this Avraham Rebbe Dosson points out, and Medrash Bamidbar Rabbah and elsewhere, every once in a while, the Torah itself makes a protective measure for one of its own prohibitions. The Ran famously, for example, says that the Torah forbids you to own chametz, that you shouldn't come to eat it. That's a siyag. The Torah forbids lo tachmod, you shouldn't come to steal it. That's not siyag la Torah, that's siyag meha Torah. The Torah itself, one of its prohibitions is a protection against the other, a protective measure. And that's a chiddush. But what we have before us, I think, is even a greater chiddush. Because the Rambam began by saying, lo tis'ave hatava mivya l'dei chimud. If you start obsessing about it, you'll come to take it from him, perhaps legally, and legally could lead to illegally. In other words, these three prohibitions are now in a chain. Lo tis'ave could lead to lo tachmud. Lo tachmud could lead to lo tigzol. That means the lo tis'ave is now what we would call a siyag l'siyag. It protects against something which itself is protection against something else. That is a chiddush, that double protection, which is, aside from anything else, is a statement about how much taking someone else's things needs to be protected against. By a double siyag. That's a chiddush. What's very interesting is, aside from the fact that these each one has its own definitions, lo tis'ave and lo tachmod, the Rambam actually codifies each of them as a negative prohibition in its own right. Lo tachmod is lo sa'aseh number 265, and lo tis'ave is negative prohibition 266. They are two separate, self-contained prohibitions of the 613. And the reason why I mention this, aside from the importance of the discussion itself, is that this further either corroborates, or perhaps more correctly, is an emanation of the fact that lo tis'ave, which is added in our parsha, which isn't in Parsha's Yisro, it cannot be Moshe's added words of explanation. Because if the additional words in our parsha are Moshe's added words of explanation, an added word of explanation doesn't constitute a separate prohibition of the Torah. You're just explaining the one that we're talking about. And therefore, implicitly, by codifying the two terms, lo tachmod in our parsha, which we had in Yisro, and lo tis'ave in our parsha, which we didn't have in Yisro, as two separate prohibitions of Taryag, that's effectively the Rambam is endorsing the idea that the text of in Vayis Chanan is a second set of luchos that came from Hashem. And in the second time, Hashem said lo tachmod and lo tis'ave. And maybe having fallen with the Egel, the Jewish people now need more protection against all sorts of things, and therefore maybe lo tachmud was enough initially. Now it needs lo tis'ave. So these are some of the discussions about the Aseres HaDibros as we find in Yisro and in Vayis Chanan, and as we came to understand, which line up with first set of luchos and second set of luchos. What's fascinating is as a kind of a PS here, every once in a while we see the Siddur functioning as a kind of a perush on the Chumash. It gives us further illumination in the psukim of the Chumash. How so? Every Shabbos, we say on Shabbos morning, Yismach Moshe b'matnas chelko, in the Shmona Esrei, in the middle of Brocha, Eben Neman, Kol Asalom, Klil Teferes, Shnei Luchos Avonim Harid B'yado, and he brought down two Luchos Avonim, tablets of stone, V'chosuv Bahem, Shmiras Shabbos. And in them was written Shmiras Shabbos. Now, what's interesting is Shmiras Shabbos relates to which part of the Aseres HaDibros? We know that on the one hand, Hashem says, Zochor Siyom HaShabbos L'Kadsho. The second time, Shomer Siyom HaShabbos L'Kadsho. We say Shomer V'Zochor B'Dibro Echad Nehmu. They were both said at the same time. But which was written in the Luchos? Well, in Yisro, it says Zohar. In Vayis Chanan, it says Shomer. Which of those two sets did Moshe bring down? The first set of Luchos was not brought down by Moshe because it was broken. The second set of Luchos was, yes, brought down. But the second set of Luchos corresponds to the Nusach as we have in Vayis Chanan. And what does it say in Vayis Chanan? Shomer es Yom HaShabbos L'Kadsho. And that's why when we talk about Moshe bringing the luchos to the people, we say v'kosuv bahem shmiras Shabbos, not zechiras Shabbos. Moshe never got to bring the luchos to the people that said zochar Yom Shabbos l'kadsho. He got to bring the second set, which says shomer. But once again, we see from the Siddur that the second set of luchos corresponds to the text of in the psukim, as we have in Parshas Vayis Chanan. Much, much more to say on this topic, as we can imagine, but let us move on just to a final idea. And it's Menyana Diyoma, and it's the well-known story of Kamsa Abar Kapsa, from which I would like to pay attention to what is arguably not such a well-known part of the story. If we would describe the story, which we know very well, there was a mix-up, Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, and Bar Kamsa was turned up, and the host demanded that he leave, and he offered to pay for half and pay for the whole, which is itself a revelation. Many people, they might not like Plony, but business is business. In other words, he offered to pay for your entire feast. It's a lot of money. Do you hate him that much? Do you hate him more than you love that amount of money? Apparently, yes. And he left, and he was humiliated and scorned, and he went to Rome and slandered the Jewish people, and then it said about things. As we can appreciate, the point of the Gemara is not that had this disaster with the feast happened, the Beis HaMikdash would never have been destroyed. Other things were happening also, but this is representative of that. And that's the story in brief. He said to bring a korban, he put a mum, they wouldn't bring it, and so on. But there's one part that it's easy to miss out, which we should not miss out. Who exactly was Bar Kamsa angry at? The Gemara doesn't say that he was angry at the host. The Gemara says that he was angry at the rabbis that were there, who saw him being humiliated and didn't do anything. It sounds like, says Bar Kamsa, they were okay with it. And moreover, not only was he angry at the Rabbanon, but when you think about it, his act of revenge to have destroyed the Beis HaMikdash is not a meaningful act of revenge against the host. Maybe the host doesn't care. It's against the Rabbanon. The shaila that we need to ask, though, of course, is once this is looms very large now, the rabbis are there, someone's been humiliated in front of them, and they don't seem to care. But how could they not? Is there any way to understand the silence of the rabbis? And maybe there is. And maybe it begins by asking what type of person is Bar Kamsa? And the background to the question is, when you think about it, if a person gets scorned and his plan as a result, as in response to that, is to destroy the Beis HaMikdash, we're not talking about the kosherest of Jews. At the time of the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, there's many different sects, there's many different groups, there's the Essenes, and there's the ascetics, and then there's the Tzidokim, who are much more hedonistic, and there's all sorts of different people. They much prefer the Greek culture of the time, which stayed long after Greece had been defeated. Greek culture in the form of Tzidokim, effectively. That was a lasting wound from which we'd never really fully recovered until the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. Tzidokim are people, if you do not subscribe to the oral Torah, keeping the written Torah is relatively easy and leaves you a lot of time and energy to pursue other things, and your Judaism doesn't need to get in the way. You can have a sentimental or nostalgic relationship with Judaism, and it doesn't need to interfere. And here's Bar Kamsa. Maybe Bar Kamsa was someone like that. And maybe that's why the rabbis, they didn't intervene when he's being insulted, because he's not really ideologically a very sound person. And so maybe he doesn't need to be defended. And maybe it'll do him good. In other words, the silence of the rabbis is because he was not one of us, really. He's one of them, and he's no good, and his ideology is no good, and therefore his dignity is not a concern. And that's stated obviously very bluntly. But the Gemara makes a point of saying that Hashem took Bar Kamsa's side. He could not have successfully made it to Rome and exacted his revenge without divine assistance. And Hashem helped him because he'd been humiliated. But what does that teach us? It teaches us a very important thing. The moral of the story is not that Tzidokim are right. Not every Jewish idea that comes out of the mouth of a Jewish person is a Jewish idea at all. Not necessarily bichlal, as we know. So not every idea that comes from a Jewish person is a Jewish idea. But the dignity of a Jewish person is a Jewish concern, whoever they are. And that is sometimes easy to forget. especially as we get locked into the people that are like us, and someone who's either to the right or to the left, as far as we're concerned, they just don't deserve it. And we may, the harsh judgment of what happened with the rabbis there is there for us to learn from. This is a very interesting comment of the Meshech Chochma in Parshas Bo. The Gemara says that Hashem wears tefillin. Gemara in Brachos, Daf Vav. And the Gemara says that in Hashem's tefillin are the praises of the Jewish people. Mika Amcha Yisrael, Goy Echad Ba'aretz. And Meshech Chochma says, you know, the head tefillin have four different compartments. The arm tefillin, everything's on the same parchment. And what does that teach you? Says the Meshech Chochma, the head tefillin is Hashem's Beinenecha, it's Hashem's supervision. Supervision of the Jewish people. Eine Hashem. Not everyone has the same level of supervision because not everyone has the same level of observance. And there is compartmentalization. There's cause and effect. People's positive and negative actions have implications and ramifications and consequences. So there's different groups when it comes to hashgacha. But on the arm, there's no different groups. They're all the same. They're all on the same parchment because the arm is next to the heart. And that's Hashem's love for the Jewish people. Hashem's views about the Jewish people depends on the person. His love for the Jewish people, it's the same parsha. And that's a lesson, I think, for us in our tefillin also. Our tefillin mirror that of Hashem. We have, in the head is this compartmentalization. Not every idea you hear from another Jew is holy of holies. Sometimes very far from it. There's a shiloh whether it could even be kashered with a blowtorch. But that's with regards to the compartments of the head. But our tefillin also have everything on the same parchment, which is keneged alef. And it's interesting to, as we know, the minhag is, it's not a halacha, but the minhag is that we don't wear tefillin on Tisha B'Av morning. And maybe part of the reason why is because we need to take time out a little bit, at least for one morning. Maybe we're not fully in line with the message of what the tefillin are saying. It could be we need a morning without them. We'll put them on in the afternoon after Chatzos. But this I think is the challenge of Ahavas Yisrael, where everyone is pro Ahavas Yisrael as long as the Yisrael in question meet their criteria as for who deserves it. So even Ahavas Chinam needs to be deserved, which is the opposite. I'm not talking about people who are sworn enemies of their own people. There's enough of those as well. But the notion that a person is doing something that's not right. That's a Shel Rosh issue and needs to be treated as such. But it's not a Shel Yad issue. And on the contrary, it begins when we see that this person has offended Hashem and we then take offense to ourselves. So we take Hashem's offense personally, more than he does. Which means that even if Hashem forgives this person, we don't. So we're trying to defend Hashem's honor in that way. But there's a mitzvah of emulating Hashem, which will come out a lot in Chumash Devarim. So how does Hashem relate to this person? Well, Pasuk says, Bonim atem l'Hashem Elokeichem. Rabbi Meir says, even if the Jewish people aren't acting as they should, which sometimes happens, they're still Hashem's children. If that's how Hashem relates to them, so to emulate Hashem perhaps should also take that attitude. It's easier said than done. And sometimes we get so caught up in our discussions and dissertations about love for the Jewish people, we forget that they're very clearly demarcated and there's people on the other side who don't deserve it. So the more we're able to deal with those barriers, the more we're able to take the message both of the Tefillin Shel Rosh and the Shel Yad, the more we can look forward to playing our part in taking a step towards the Geula, which should come with Beseres Tovos, Yeshua's Venachomas for the Jewish people, and it should be Bekorah.